Talking Attorney, Eric Jackson Lurie. And you're listening to Courts in Session, heard here every Thursday night from 8 to 10:30 with a replay Friday early morning for you night owls that haven't gone to bed after Viva La Mock. You can hear Courts in Session at 1:30 in the morning. And again, after the Steelers' victory and after the New and Newer show here in WRCT, Sunday nights at 10 p.m. You say, what is Viva La Mock? Well, remember that kid that you were always protecting in high school because he was getting picked on? Well, 26 years on the radio, ladies and gentlemen. The Mockster, he's been doing it a long time and doing it well, but don't tell him I said that. His head is big enough as it is. A great show, spinning the best and worst in indie punk, classic country, power pop, a whole lot more, and you don't want to miss his Friday night mock, where he picks a subject and mocks it, plays songs by an artist or a subject every week at midnight, right here in WRCT, 9 to 1:30 in the morning, and after that, yours truly. So that last set of music started off with a request going out to Elena, listening online at WRCT.org in Greece. She sent me a message. She said, who's your favorite Uriah Heep singer, David Byron or John Lawton? Well, Elena, I'm going with David Byron, and that's why going out to you, beauty, one way or another, going back to 1976 from the Heap. You know, it's crazy these days. Radio is truly worldwide. Whitesnake from their last album, the single, Shut Up and Kiss Me, my favorite thing to say to my wife when she gets mad at me. Sometimes it works. Live Deep Purple celebrating the life and legacy of John Lord. The band got together with a symphony and a whole lot of guest artists. And, of course, you heard Perfect Strangers. Johnny Rivers, one of my favorites, one of the few guys that I absolutely love that I've never seen live. If you know Johnny, tell him, don't retire just yet. EJL's got to get there. Going back to the Road album with Wait a Minute. Well, you're not going to wait any longer because we're going to play brand new Willie Nelson. He's got a brand new Christmas single out. The song is short. The song is sweet. Courts in Session is rock and roll, country, and soul. Give this a listen. This is Christmas Love Song, WRCT 88.3 FM.
Pretty paper and they're lying there under the tree. There's one that can't wait for that big day. I guess you could say it's kind of special to me. This is my Christmas love song to you. It ain't a lot, but every word love is true. It don't sparkle or shine, but it's one of a kind that I put my whole heart into. This Christmas love song to you. For granted this wonderful life that we found. I am so blessed to call you mine that I had to stop and write it all down. This is my Christmas love song to you.
Scott from England. You're listening to Eric Jackson Lurie on WRCT Pittsburgh 88.3 FM. Enjoy.
Sneak up from the night. I see our face.
Don't Quit, brand new. Robin, Rick, Tom, the guys in Cheap Trick, new album's called All Washed Up, and got it here on vinyl. And I'll tell you what, Cheap Trick has officially become a family affair. You know, Buddy Carlos, the terrific drummer from Cheap Trick, left the band, a good 10-plus years ago. And he was replaced by Rick's son, Dax, Dax Nelson. And now for the first time on an album, officially, Robin Zander's son, Robin Taylor Zander, on guitars and vocals. How about that? A true family rock and roll band. I like it. And I like that track a lot. New music from classic artists right here in Quartz in Session. Before the Cheap Trick, man, that Craig Jakisco solo is still one of my favorites. From the Modern Times album, Jefferson Starship, going back to 1981 with Save Your Love. This is one of my favorite periods for the Jefferson Starship band. Scorpions, before they made it big in America, they were crushing it in Europe. Title track from the album, Entrance, back in the days of Uli John Roth. And Uli is coming to Jurgles April 22nd. We're going to get Uli on the show. He was scheduled. We had a little workaround we had to do, so we're going to have him on coming up in upcoming weeks. But he's going to join us here in Quartz in Session. And more importantly, he's coming to Pittsburgh. And he told me he is doing a double set, the first set, with a group of classical musicians who are going to join him with his classically oriented rock and roll. He's going to do a art presentation while they're playing the first set, take an intermission, and then he's going to come out and rock out the Scorpions. So that is going to be great. One of the all-time guitar greats. Actual influence on Yngwie Malmsteen, coming to Pittsburgh April 22nd. Open it up with brand new music from Willie Nelson. How about that? Christmas love song. Guys, I'm going to play that again next week. That was terrific. Well, we are getting near the end of the line. I can see the finish line. Quartz in Session's not over just yet. You may have heard that Steve Cropper, legendary guitarist, passed away this week. Well, let's play something in his honor. One of his biggest hits he ever played on when he was a part of Booker T and the MGs. This is Green Onions. live Bad Company back in the Brian Howe days in the early 90s. You listen to Courts in Session, and ladies and gentlemen, Courts in Session is now officially Courts adjourned. I'm your rocking attorney, Eric Jackson Lurie. Thanking you for joining me tonight. A great time. Bunch of winners tonight to see the Rolling Stones in IMAX. Gonna be a good time. Want to remind you to get together. Well, let's try that again. Want to remind you to let's get back together next Thursday night at 8. I will be live with you all over again. Take care of each other. Be kind to each other. And be proud to be American. Good night, Pittsburgh.
Happening with this generation is really trying to have the rhetoric mean something, not to throw out the rhetoric, but to say, okay, guys, we're being tested. What are we going to do? What are we going to do? Not what are we going to say, but what are we going to do? Are we going to divest? Are we going to not let weapons companies recruit on our campus? Like, what are we going to do materially that we can do? And we have to do it.
That's Naomi Klein. And this is Alternative Radio. I'm David Barsamyan. This edition of AR features Naomi Klein. What are we going to do? The day after the Trump election, the New York Times wrote, America stands on the precipice of an authoritarian style of governance never before seen in its 248-year-old history. For many, the results of November 5th confirm the view that we are in dark times. So the big question is, what are we going to do? We can wallow in self-pity and depression, or we can find kindred spirits, organize, and form alliances to not just resist the repression to come, but to promote progressive causes. As writer Rebecca Solnit says, not acting is a luxury those in immediate danger do not have, and despair something they cannot afford. But despair is all around us, telling us the problems are insoluble, that we are not strong enough, our efforts are in vain, and no one really cares. Hope, Rebecca Solnit says, counteracts cynicism and pessimism. Our guest today is Naomi Klein. She's professor in the Department of Geography at the University of British Columbia. Her writing has appeared in leading publications around the world. She's a columnist for The Guardian. She's the award-winning author of such bestsellers as No Logo, The Shock Doctrine, On Fire, and Doppelganger. She spoke at the University of Colorado at Boulder at the end of October. The moderator is Professor Nabil Isha Aibi. And now, Naomi Klein.
I want to thank everybody who invited me here. It's been a long time since I've been on this wonderful campus, and it's got such a rich activist tradition, green activism and human rights and anti-war. I want to shout out the students who have been organizing and taking risks, including students who've been suspended for their activism. But I really do want to thank you for just your boldness, because courage is it really is a muscle, you know. And when we start saying, well, maybe not this week, we get used to it, and suddenly it feels like a bigger deal to just do what it is our unbelievable privilege to do: read, think, discuss, debate. How lucky are we, you know, who work at universities, whether we are on faculty or whether we're students, that this is actually our job. This is what we're doing here. This is our work. And when we voluntarily shut ourselves up, I think it's such a disservice to people who are having to do so much more difficult work and who don't have that privilege of just being asked to tell the truth for a living, for their studies. So thank you so much.
I want to start, you know, with a few questions, obviously, about the book, and congratulations on Doppelganger and the success that it's had. And there is this line in the book where you're talking about your book, The Shock Doctrine. When you shared the galleys with John Berger, the writer, he told you that that book, you know, and like what other people had told you, that The Shock Doctrine actually enraged them. He told you that it provoked and instilled in him a sense of calm. And I want to start there.
Okay.
This idea of calmness and calm as a form of resistance in times of shock and also times of chaos and confusion.
Yeah. To be clear, I don't, you know, when I say that I'm trying to bring a sense of calm, you know, to myself and to the reader, I'm not trying to make you panic. I'm not saying everything is fine. You know, I'm not saying chill out. But I do think that it is a precondition for being strategic, for making priorities, and that when we are in a state of shock, we have event without a narrative that can explain that event. And that's when we get vulnerable and become vulnerable to people who would manipulate us. I got interested in this after 9/11, watching how powerful people in this country in particular, but around the world, used the shock of 9/11 to regress us, to tell us that nothing we knew before applied. There was this phrase that some of you who are you know, old enough to remember that period will recall, which was they would say, oh, that's pre-9/11 thinking, as if nothing you knew before mattered. And in fact, the impulse that many, many people had was to get oriented, to get out of shock, and to do that together. By gathering, you know, there were these spontaneous gatherings around New York City where people just got together and talked in different squares. People, you know, Noam Chomsky's book sold out, you know, because people wanted to understand, okay, why do they hate us? What happened? And in response to that, there was like, to try to understand is to betray, is to rationalize, right? You know, we heard this after October 7th as well. Anything contextualizing, right, is a thought crime. History began on October 7th. That's all that matters. And everything, you know, nothing justified October 7th, but just October 7th justifies everything. I think, you know, one of the things I noticed from immersing myself in conspiracy culture and following my doppelganger down her various rabbit holes and listening to a lot of Steve Bannon is the affect of that world is panic. It's there's always a hot new reason for you to panic. And I think that that's because when you are panicked, you are childlike. You're looking for, you know, a strong arm figure to stabilize you, protect you, right? And, you know, I'm sure we're all thinking about different people who are playing that role. So, yeah, I mean, I want us to be as calm as we can be in the storms that we are in, because I think that that's how we are at our best. But it isn't to minimize the fact that there's a hell of a lot for us to be very, very deeply and seriously concerned about. It's not the British kind of keep calm and carry on sort of thing. I absolutely do I believe in revolutionary change. I mean, I think that business as usual is catastrophic on many different fronts. For me as a writer, I'm always trying to get unpanicked and calm. I mean, all of my books are attempts to impose some kind of an order. And it's not that the world is ordered when I'm done. It's that my thoughts are ordered and I'm able to interact with the world. And I think that's what we look to nonfiction for, fiction a little bit less so, but you know, we, and I think that's what, you know, the wonderful late John Berger was saying to me. And I was so moved by it. You know, I think he was not shocked by the information in the shock doctrine. He remembered many of the events, and when he was saying he felt calm, was that it was there on the page. The shock doctrine looks at different torture techniques that deliberately discombobulate the senses, right? That this is what, you know, I look at the CIA torture manual and all of the sort of sensory deprivation, confusion between day and night. You know, it's all about making us confused about where we are in time and space, because that is when a prisoner is vulnerable and less able to, you know, defend themselves, make decisions, and when they're most likely to give up information and so on. I just spent 3 days staying in Times Square in New York because I was at the New Yorker Festival, and that's where they put us up. I had never stayed in Times Square before. It's such a strange place. I'm like, why are they confusing me between day and night here? It was so hard to sleep. It's like, you people think this is fun? This is really... anyway...
Yeah, no, it's interesting. This is what you've been saying all along, is that we have to get unshocked in order to start doing the work, because to remain in a state of shock is exactly what these forces want us to remain as, right? So you mentioned 9/11, but everything else that's happening, whether it's a climate catastrophe or anything like that, is to maintain us in that state of shock.
Right, and shock, you know, and I say this in the shock doctrine, but that really what it is not a state of shock, is not something bad happening. It's something bad happening that you don't understand yet, right? It's the gap that opens up between event and narrative that explains that event. And in that gap, we are vulnerable. And that's why we understand that, and we want to fill it. Okay, what don't I know? And so there are really healthy responses, like I was describing about 9/11, and you know, the fact that Rashid Khalidi's, you know, the 100-year war on Palestine has played that role for a lot of people since October 7th. I mean, that book has gone wild for exactly this impulse. I'm filling in blanks in my education, you know, and lots of other books too. The tricky thing with our online lives, right? And you know, I wrote this book in this sort of deep in COVID lockdown, was that when we confronted a novel virus that we didn't yet understand, many of us didn't read epidemiology. Like, we went online and we just found like random health influencers. And, you know, it's the nature of the attention economy that when people follow that sort of, I think, quite healthy impulse to close the gap between event and narrative, they end up in the world of grift. And I think that's the biggest change since I've been following shocks, is that now conspiracy is monetizable. And that was not, you know, that was not the case like when I covered Hurricane Katrina, for instance. There were conspiracies about the levees being deliberately exploded, or there were conspiracies about 9/11. There are conspiracies, you know, I think whenever people are trying to understand, particularly when they're being taken advantage of, then they're trying to understand, okay, well, all these people are getting rich off of my misery. Maybe they did it on purpose, but nobody was getting rich off of that. You know, I mean, maybe the guys who made Loose Change, it was a much more kind of human scale problem. Whereas now, part of what I've called the disaster capitalism complex is the dissemination of misinformation, because that information is going to get you the maximum traction when people are panicked, right? So we saw it just recently during Hurricane Helene. What is happening? This is not a part of the country that is supposed to be hit, right? If we're thinking about, you know, Asheville or these mountainous parts, which actually saw themselves as climate refuges, right? They were supposed to be some of the least impacted areas. Suddenly, homes are floating down the street. And, you know, into that breach, into that gap come, maybe the government is controlling the weather, right? Maybe they're after the lithium, maybe they're after, you know, and it becomes this kind of tornado of misinformation, much of it contradictory. And this is the point that I get into in the section of the book called The Conspiracy is Capitalism, which is that really, if you think about who benefits from that, we're not talking about the conspiracies we know about. You know, I know there's some great climate scientists here and people who, you know, we actually know that Exxon and all the other big oil companies have been deliberately spreading misinformation about climate. We know their own climate scientists back to the 1970s understood incredibly well not only the connection between their core product and warming, but their models were incredibly accurate. We know this through peer-reviewed science. That's a pretty consequential conspiracy. But while we're talking about the, you know, Marjorie Taylor Greene version, or maybe people aren't being saved because the migrants got the money, well, that it actually benefits elites. So the posture is we're taking on the elites, but of course the people who are so happy to spread it are some of the richest people on the planet, like Elon Musk, who's a one-man conspiracy himself, right? So, I mean, it's an elite protection racket, this whole monetized conspiracy world, if that makes sense.
I'm interested in sort of distinction that you make about conspiracy culture versus conspiracy theory. I mean, I think you say that we should pay very close attention to the fact that we're no longer dealing with the conspiracy theories of, you know, a decade ago or two decades, but we should be really paying attention to this new culture. And if you could say a little bit more about the danger and the risks that we're running because of the fact that we went from conspiracy theory into conspiracy culture.
It's important to me that we recognize that there are real conspiracies in the world. You know, Adam Smith said, you know, rarely do people from the same industry get together in private that it doesn't end up in some form of price fixing, right? It's not mysterious. It's not as salacious as the kind of QAnon version of like, oh, they're trying to drain the adrenochrome from these kids to live forever. It's just kind of capitalism doing its thing. And usually it does it in public, but sometimes it does it in private. And, you know, the shock doctrine was a history of the uses of shocks, coup d'etats, dirty tricks, in order to impose neoliberal economics, which we were then told, you know, spread around the world through freedom and light. And it's also true that left-wing analysts and researchers often get called conspiracy theorists as a way to dismiss them, right? So I don't call these folks conspiracy theorists. I call them conspiracy influencers or conspiracy fantasists, just because I have too much respect for theory to do that, you know? And there isn't really a theory. It's sometimes called conspiracy without a theory. And because it is so much a part of the attention economy and so much about getting the clicks, the theories often wildly contradict one another. So we saw this during COVID, like, you know, early days, where it was all about the masks. Don't mask, it's just a cold, right? But then it was like, no, it's a bioweapon. And then it was like, no, the vaccine is the bioweapon. It's like, but nobody ever tried to resolve these different conspiracies. They were just kind of like, they would just match every phase of what people were talking about. And then a new story really would emerge that was going to ride that wave, right? Kind of clout chasing, really. I think that we end up not talking about the conspiracies that are right in front of us, because there was a huge amount of very real disaster profiteering during the pandemic. We saw, you know, the world's 10 richest people double their wealth. We saw tech companies taking advantage of remote schooling in order to push their products. We saw vaccines, which frankly, I don't think should have ever been patented in the first place, because they were developed with public funds. It was, you know, it was a fee-for-service arrangement with our governments. Why was so much wealth made off of these vaccines? And we also saw vaccine hoarding in the global north. So there were many things that we could have been talking about instead of talking about whether Bill Gates is trying to inject something to track you, you know, and, you know, instead of whether or not this was like a plot to make women infertile or whatever. And this is the kind of thing that my doppelganger, Naomi Wolf, was at the center of, which is why she became kind of an interesting sort of, you know, I call her like the white rabbit that led me down the rabbit hole. She's not the subject of the book, but she's a major player in the world of medical misinformation and disinformation. There was a study that found that she was sort of ground zero of the vaccine shedding myth, the idea that people who were vaccinated were shedding their vaccine particles onto unvaccinated people, and it was causing them to, you know, maybe be infertile or affecting their periods and things like that. That was one of her big things. And like you talked about the facts wrong and the feelings right, she really had her breakthrough when she started saying that the vaccine verification apps that we all had on our phones were actually listening in on our phone conversations and listening in on our conversations in person, and were part of a plan to bring a Chinese-style social credit system to the United States. So once she said this, then suddenly she's on Tucker Carlson, she's on Steve Bannon's show every day. And what I realized was that she was wrong about the facts of this. Like, these vaccine verification apps were not eavesdropping on our conversations. They weren't surveillance devices. But, you know, the response from, like, liberal Twitter was this really kind of snide, like, well, wait till they hear about cell phones, right? Which I found really interesting because it speaks to the fact that we all are incredibly uneasy about the fact that we live in a surveillance state and that we don't know what our phones are doing with our data, and we all have had that weird experience, like, it's my phone listening to me? What is going on right now? But we're not actually doing anything about it, right? And the Democrats aren't doing anything about it, even though they sort of said that they were going to, right? And so the response to this misinformation about the vaccine verification apps is like, well, world-weary people understand that it's really just our cell phones that are doing all of those things, right? But why are we okay with that, right? And so if we've somehow normalized this level of surveillance, then of course Steve Bannon and Tucker Carlson are going to tap into the fact that people have very strong feelings about surveillance, as well we should. We should all be very worried about it. We should look for real solutions to it. We shouldn't project all of it onto a vaccine verification app. There are real questions about those apps, by the way. Like, any time you digitize life further and, you know, make people have to have cell phones, you know, you are restricting who's going to have access to these spaces. I'm not a big fan of it. But I was really struck that they were projecting all of our collective fears about surveillance onto these one apps, and they were getting the facts wrong, but they were getting the feelings right. And they're only able to do that if we are no longer addressing those surveillance fears. So this is what really has interested me about and scared me and chilled me about studying the Bannon right, if you will, or the MAGA right, is that I see them doing a kind of mix and match with a lot of issues that used to very much be issues of the left. You know, in particular, the issues that I came up in, right? I wrote a book called No Logo. I was part of the alter globalization movement that was very much focused on corporate power, corporate control of the media, the fact that just a handful of companies were consolidating in every single industry. And we no longer really have a left that is squarely focused on that, right? And this is the thing about Bannon, is he always looks at the issues that we have abandoned, and he takes it and then he mixes and matches it with xenophobia, with racism, you know, and he makes this like Frankenstein kind of cocktail doppelganger of the left. And he did it with free trade in 2016, and now he's doing it with, you know, big media, big pharma. So those were the moments when I felt really disconcerted in my research, was when I'd be listening to Bannon and he'd sound a little like me and Bernie, you know, and Amy Goodman, you know, where he be. And so, and then I would go, well, are we still talking about this? I'm not sure we're talking about it with the same kind of focus. You know, yes, we must speak, but we also have to reunite our words with action, because I think a lot of what is happening with the backlash against the Democrats and against the left generally is just this feeling of like, these are people that just perform their politics. They talk down to people, but they're all a bunch of hypocrites because they don't actually match it with action. You know, where we see the veil pierced sometimes in a glimpse of another kind of politics is when, you know, somebody like Sean Fain, who's head of the, you know, the auto workers union, talks about, you know, eating the rich, and, you know, his Eat the Rich t-shirt, and comes out and says, you know, we're gonna get a new contract for auto workers, and you know, record profits mean record wages. And so he's not just posturing, he's not just, you know, wearing an Eat the Rich gown. I mean, he's actually talking about getting a share of the profits, right? And that's the kind of thing Trump doesn't want to deal with. That's the kind of thing that Bannon doesn't want to deal with, which is why he didn't want Trump to run against Bernie, because there's a lot of artifice going on, but there's also a lot of artifice going on in the Democratic Party. So, like, when I watched the RNC from start to finish, everyone's like, "Why did you do that?" Because you got to watch these folks, you know. But it's amazing because it's like it's like this mashup of everything that is just sort of defiantly fake, right? It's just like, it's beauty pageants and pro wrestling and stadium rock and reality television and all these things that are like, they're not pretending to be real, and everyone's kind of in on it, and it's just dialed up to like a million. And so we all understand, like, that's fake, you know? But then you look at the DNC and it's like, is this prestige TV? Like, what is this? This is like Coach Walls is kind of like Ted Lasso, you know? And then, you know, Kamala Harris is like the lovable police chief in every procedural drama you've ever seen, right? But it's like nobody's really actually engaging with reality, right? I mean, if you're saying, yeah, we believe climate change is real, but let's please have much more fracking, right? So I'm not saying that they're equivalent, but I'm saying that when you aren't actually willing to get real about where we are, you're leaving a door wide open for people who come in with a defiantly fake message. But the part of their project that's real is the hate. That's what they can deliver on. They can deliver on the dominance. They can deliver on, you can have control over your kids again and your wife again and, you know, the border again. And, that stuff's cheap.
And it feels like the other side is just doing reactive politics, right? Sort of, we're not doing it. You have this line, this incredible line on page 152 about your friend Bill McKibben, the author of The End of Nature, talking about the futility of words. And you say, quote, what if our books, our movements as they are currently constructed, often in ways that resemble brands, are only changing words? What if words written on the page or shouted in protest change only what people and institutions say and not what they do? I mean, this is clearly, as you just described, is the risk that we're facing, but are we all suffering from what Greta Thunberg says, blah, blah, blah? I mean, is that what we could all be accused of?
I think so. Before I go to that, but you know, I do believe that Greta's blah, blah, blah speech was one of the greatest sort of political interventions of all time. It was really interesting. You know, I think it was 2022. The UN Climate Summit was in Glasgow. And up to that point, Greta had played a very particular role in the culture, which is, you know, she would be invited to these conferences and to these elite gatherings like Davos, and she would come and she would be invited to scold people, right? To plead with people, to say, how dare you? How dare you do this to our future? And then they would all take selfies with her, you know? Do it again, please, you know, and fist bump her and all of this. And it's very clear that she got sick of it. And this is the last time she's gone to a COP. She has stopped going. And she goes to Glasgow, and every microphone that gets put in front of her, she just says, they're here to do the blah, 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 green economy, blah, 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 build back better, blah, blah, blah. Yeah, they have an agreement. They even managed to water down the blah, 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 which is quite an accomplishment. That was her statement. And then she went and got arrested trying to stop a coal plant. And she also has been very outspoken on Palestine. And she has said very clearly that these are not separate issues. You know, and I think this is true for so many young climate activists, that the motivation for getting involved in climate justice is about valuing life, human and other than human. But anything that treats life as disposable must be resisted at all costs. So, of course, there is a genocide happening, and there is a genocide happening in Gaza, then of course you must stand up and say no. Because if that level of atrocity is normalized, anything is possible, which is why Gustavo Petro, the president of Colombia, the country, not the university, said the Global South sees their future in Gaza. This is, if this becomes normalized, if this is acceptable, if it becomes ambient to our lives, to quote Jonathan Glazer, who made Zone of Interest, then this will be the future on every border. And this is why I say that the Iron Dome is global. You know, if we want to understand why our governments are lining up across party lines around the global north to support Israel, it's because our governments are invested in protecting the same levels of injustice and inequality at our borders, often with the same technologies. There's a rupture that is happening with the blah, blah, blah on our campuses. And this is why I thank you, you know, really profoundly for speaking, because honestly, we can't take it for granted. I've been on a little mini campus tour and been staggered by some of the silence that I've encountered, by the self-censorship that I've encountered. And I think for so many young people who go to universities that do land acknowledgements, that talk about EDI, that celebrate young people for being climate activists, standing up for human rights, but then when they stood up against genocide in Gaza, had the police called on them or at Homeland Security and are suddenly being treated like the enemy within, it's not just Donald Trump, it breeds a profound cynicism and loss of faith, right? And so what I see happening with this generation is really trying to have the rhetoric mean something, not to throw out the rhetoric, but to say, okay, guys, we're being tested. What are we going to do? What are we going to do? Not what are we going to say, but what are we going to do? Are we going to divest? Are we going to not let weapons companies recruit on our campus? Like, what are we going to do materially that we can do? And we have to do it.
You're listening to Naomi Klein. What are we going to do? This is Independent Alternative Radio. To get copies of this program and for her Doppelganger book, call us 1-800-444-1977. Again, 1-800-444-1977. Or online, our website, alternativeradio.org.
I wanted to ask you about how the figure of the doppelganger helps you get to all of these conclusions and also issue these warnings about what's going on. I'm just curious about how your story about Wolf is not a specific story. It's not a personal story. It's actually a story about how it is also a universal story. It's about how societies and countries have become doppelgangers of themselves. Right, whether it's Israel, whether it's the United States, whether it's, you know, or any other society. Yeah. And you say on page 274, what if the full-blown fascism is not the monster at the door, but the monster inside the house, the monster inside of us? Right? This is the biggest danger, right? Sort of, we follow you in the story about Wolf, but we shouldn't really just